pictures of where I grew up. And where I grew up, there was this ships, army ships that came in every spring, every summer, bringing supplies for their camp. There was an army camp next door, and next door to our camp. They lived in Quonset huts. And our family pretty much had all Eskimo attire, no rubber boots, no nothing, because they were the best. They're all handmade, the sunshine roof, rough for the parkas. And
where would you get this material? There's lots of like, I don't know, pattern material.
Brought in, and especially when they go to Fairbanks, there's this long time ago, before materials came, they had flour sacks for snow shirts. These materials, when they start commuting back and forth to Fairbanks through the plane, that's when, you know, they get that material, those beautiful materials they got, they have. So, like I said, they hunted, they also hunted wolves over there. And like I said, I mentioned the death of our grandmother, that's how they buried them, just made homemade coffins and put canvas on top of it.
You buried them?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, we buried them under the permafrost, the ground, summertime. And see the attire? That's when it started, rubber boots. Probably 1940s. Early 1940s. Yeah, but you notice that I think he has Eskimo mukluks.
Yeah.
So this is me. That was the best time of our lives, was Christmas. This is my brother Ben, and everybody would gather and have a Christmas feast. And this is the Christmas programs. That's where Dr. Harold Kaviluk was our teacher. He would produce, direct, and all the plays that we do, all the singing that we do. And this is what I was talking about, the seal. Whenever somebody catches seal, that's what we use for food and for our mukluks, the skin and the blubber we use for seal oil. That's how we survive. That's what we grew up with. We mainly grew up with polar bear meat, seal meat, and squirrels, and sheep was very prominent at that time. And when they accidentally got the mother or something like that, and they find out that there's cubs, they would bring them home and keep them as pets. And
how long would that last?
Until they were too big to take care of. I said, go away, go away. And this is our activities was Achikisak. We call it Achikisak with a wood. It's a board.
Like a seesaw.
Seesaw board, yeah. And this is how we did it, Apana Rampana. And then this is what I mentioned about sliding on the snow. A lot of activities for the children when I was growing up. And so there's our family. This is my sister, Priscilla. And Christmas time, that's our cousins. So growing up, this is all my aunt's pictures. Growing up, she took me in when I was going to high school. That's what I liked about my aunt today. I take care of her, and there's another. You know, women were taught, we were so like, we hunted too, as women. You notice she knows how to operate an outboard motor. And we were taught to be self-sufficient. It wasn't like, this is only for men, this is only for women. It wasn't like that. It was, we grew up poor. Our mom, like I said, learned how to be a sharpshooter with a gun. And so, this is our dad, Benson. Oh, yeah. He had a store, and he would come up here to Fairbanks to get supplies for the store. I remember growing up and sleeping on top of a whole bunch of cases of milk. That's where I grew up. So it's just a small piece. And then, like I said, we moved to Barrow. And this is, it's all. And this is when we first moved, about 5 years after we moved. Our house is right next door to this house. This is Mom, and they visited from Kraktovik, Herman and Mildred. They adopted our sister, Miriam, the oldest in Mom's family. And this is Mom with blood relatives. We come from a really big family relations. This is our oldest, James, when he got married. And our young women were taught how to sew, you know. And the men went out and caught these white foxes to make money also, or to go to the store and get white man's food. We grew up only eating Eskimo food. So, and this is another phase. That's what today is going to consist of, is just letting you know where I'm coming from, the relations, my grandfather, parents were Allahraq and Ingiluk, and they Allahraq and Ingiluk had Fenton, Elsie, Azia, Tigiluk. That, and Elsie was his wife, I'm sorry. Tigiluk, Azeak, Akutuk, which is Andrew Akutuk, and Ayak. Those were the parents of our grandfather Andrew Akuchuk, and the parents of my grandmother Susie Terigiluk were Adam and Eve. Alasurak and Klinak. Even before they named, I think the only time that they started calling them English names were when white men came to our village. So they called them Adam and Eve, dog. Alasurak and Klinak. Her brother, oldest, Richmond Ulogak, and she was next, Susie Terigiluk, and also Tuluk was her siblings, Tuluk and Paul Patkudak. So anybody that has like Digiluk and Aviak, any persons that have that last name, Digiluk, Aviak, Gordon, and Ulimans and Ikuanas and Hobsons and Paminyakunas, they're all related to us. And I would highly recommend, I know that it's in the internet, and what I want you to do is to also find out about your family tree. It's beautiful one. I never knew until I was like in my late 30s, I think. I didn't know anything about this, and I said, oh my gosh, am I related to that person? And it's beautiful. Once you learn about your genealogy, it's just like, wow. It's a beautiful feeling to know where you came from and who was related to you. Because sometimes when you're going out and you're living like this right now, I'm living like this, I don't feel alone anymore because I went to my aunt's birthday party, and being in touch with family is really very, very, very important. So Mom had 9 children. James Mumeraluk, Mary Ann, who was adopted to our aunt. Anyway, adopted to our aunt, Melvin and Herman Russell. Priscilla, Nariak, Lloyd, Tigiluk, Nariak, Ida, that's me, Sidana, and Benjamin Putua, but he was here earlier at the AFM. Benjamin, Roy, Benson Jr., and Susie. So in our family, there's Martha Aiken, Raymond Miyakok, James Nagayak, Marianne Warden, Priscilla Sage, Lloyd Nagayak, Edith Nagayak, Benjamin Nagayak, Roy Nagayak, Benson Nagayak Jr., and Susie Nagayak. And in our family, Rhoda Akuchuk, I already told you about who her parents are, Andrew and Susie Akuchuk. And our dad, his real father was Pumuyuk, and real mother was Ala. He got adopted to Knaktak and Kushak when Alak, his real mom, died. Knaktak and Kushak adopted our dad, Benson Nayak, Sr. And our dad has brothers, Kenton. They grew up together. Lara Avakana, Kenton, and also Dorothy Bonnyhoma. They grew up together because he was adopted, and the brothers are Mikiana, Daniel Kenton, Dorothy Gordon, and the other sibling, Laura Avakana. They grew up together. That's who his brother and sister were. So this is your opportunity. We have 3 sessions, and I would love to give you all this. I don't want to overwhelm you, but all this information. I love telling about my family, and it is your task. This is your opportunity to ask whatever you ever wanted to know about our culture, the Inupiaqs, the Eskimos from the north.
All right, this is Holly. I'm talking with Edith today on October 31st. And I was going to ask about Inupiaq art forms. And you said your parents used to make masks.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of materials would they use? And yeah, could you talk about
caribou skin?
Caribou skin.
I remember our dad would start taking the fur out of the caribou with the ulu like this. It's an Eskimo knife, which is shaped like. Anyway, it's a very good, we don't call it a knife, it's something that's made out of steel, and we sharpen it once in a while, and that's what our dad used, was to scrape the fur out of the caribou skin, and then they would shape, cut a round piece of that caribou already cut, take the fur off from the caribou. That caribou skin cut about like a couple of round, like the face size. Cut that, and then they would have tea water by the stove, or coffee, to make this, because it's white, the caribou skin is white, so they put that round caribou and soak it in that tea water or coffee water until probably overnight, and then after that they would put it on a mold. The mold is made where you could make it as big as you want, but ours was a real life mask mold. It's a wooden mold, and they shape the nose and the eyes and the mouth. And I remember on that mold were holes by the eyes, holes on the inside of the eyes, outside of the eyes, and also by the nose, and by the by the mouth, on both sides of the mouth. That's where the holes were. And so after that caribou skin was soaked, they would put that skin on the mold, and they would use sinew to put those sinews on the hole and shape it, make it tight around the mold so that it would be like a face. So they dried up overnight, a day or so overnight, dry up the caribou, and when it's dried up they take it out, and it would be shaped, it would be hard, the caribou skin would be hard, and then they start working on opening the eyes and opening the mouth to shape it and take the rest of the skin off. And then I remember our mom would start putting the eyebrows, putting the eyebrows and the eyelashes. It was wonderful the way she did it. She would use calfskin, black calfskin for the eyebrows and lashes, to make it look like a human being, and sometimes she would put caribou skin if it's a man. She could make both female or man, and on the male, I know she would put caribou skin, because it's like white, and the hair would be caribou skin. It's just so amazing. It looks like human hair, like 60-year-old man or whatever. They would use the caribou hair for the mustache and for the hair, and on the woman, I remember she would use part of a wolverine and make it look like the woman has black hair, and it would look like it was parted, you know, the hair. They would have long hair, and it would look like it had hair right there. And for the ruff, she would use wolf skin. She would use wolf skin for the ruff. And all this would be all in, all handmade. And I think when glue came around, they used that to put the eyebrows on. Whereas before, they would, you know, total sewing all around the mask. And one time they made a whole bunch of those masks. And they acquired a skidoo, to purchase a skidoo by selling these masks. That was income for them to do that, and it was like, wow. You know, they get busy and start making the mask when they want to buy something, they just go ahead and do that.
Who do they sell the masks? Do they go out of town?
No.
City, or just
They had connections though, you know, here. During the World Eskimo Indian Olympics, they would have buyers.
Mm-hmm.
And the tourists, of course, is a good source for income. They would sell them. And they would have people that were interested in buying, they knew the connections or the people who could be, who would be interested in buying the masks.
So do they usually make masks that look like human faces? Like try to make them pretty representative?
Mm-hmm. But I remember one time, it was this time, this day, Halloween, Mom would make funny masks. Mm-hmm. She would. She was one of the top prize getters for first place. She would make a mask. Real, you know. I remember one time she made it look so funny. She was so talented. And so there's a different way that you can make masks. But in our area, this was given to them by a friend from Anaktuvuk Pass. I think that's where the mask making started, was in Anaktuvuk Pass. They didn't make any mask at home. The art that was at home was the baling basket making. Our grandfather, Khingaktak and Kushhak, were very well known for their basket, baling basket making. So in our area, baling baskets and ivory and those were the art that were made by local people. And the baling also, they make baling boats, and they would sell those baling, make art on the balings and sell those also. But it wasn't totally for sale. It was it was an honor to receive something like a baling basket or something that somebody has made as a gift. They would make those. Or a long time ago, they would like trade also, whereas you know, they kept that artwork here, but pretty soon they started bartering and trading and with other different people.
Would you also use the masks in things like dancing and for like celebrations that you would have? Did you ever like use the masks for like performance dancing?
I haven't seen any in our area up there in Barrow, but down towards maybe Point Hope, I've seen them use masks. The ones in particular that were used with our dance group was the loom. They made a headdress. They used it on their heads when they were doing the box drum dance. It's totally a real loom with a beak in the front, and you could tell it's a loom, you know, and then it's a headdress out of that. But no, I haven't seen any masks in the Eskimo dance performance. But only places like Point Hope or like down in Bethel area.
Mm-hmm. What kind of artwork did you use in dancing? Do you make dance fans?
Dance fans? I was just... Wait, I'll be right back. The drum is artwork.
Mm-hmm.
The drum that was made. A long time ago, the drum was made out of a terrible membrane. Stomach and whale. Nowadays they're starting to make it, the young people. My nephew has made a genuine drum. That is art. And these are the maklaks that were made. They're made out of cow skin, black and white cow skin, and you see the intricate artwork. That is art. When they make the maklaks, they're beautiful. They're made out of black and white cow skin. That is art.
Is all this black cow skin?
Uh-huh.
With just other white fabric?
There's, they make it out of cow skin and uruk skin on the bottom, the white uruk skin. And this is wolverine. They use these wolverine's tassels on the maklaks. So there's a lot of work. This is a lot of work to make these Eskimo maklaks. And a long time ago, when performances, celebrations, people would come in their best attires and they would come in with their hand-sewn squirrel parkas with tassels on them, and the sunshine roof, the ladies would come and the men would come in with their squirrel jackets with these intricate artwork on the trimmings of their jackets and the wolf rough. That is art.
Is the sunshine rough wolf? Is that wolf?
Yes.
The rough?
It's, yes. It's wolf. The rough is wolf. So they use wolverine, wolf, calfskin, bearded seal on the bottom for the soils, for the maklaks. And also during the box drum dance I said earlier, they had made mittens with ivory tassels on them, and they still have them during the performances. And I remember Mom making one, and it's all sealskin, making it look like but I remember Mom putting something so that men, they could use it as a mitten, but they did use those during the box drum performance.
Like the tassels would make noise?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So it'd be part of the dance?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it would be made out of ivory. The tassels would be made out of ivory. And speaking of art, they would dye these seal skins with red dye. I remember it wasn't just total calf skin. I remember Mom making muckluffs, and they would, I would love to see that kind of muckluffs today by women. It's strips of seal skin, and they're dyed red, and they would make this beautiful artwork, weaving, making the art work. So they had done that before casting. They used sealskin. They used the white and then they dyed with red. Or even, I don't know, red was mainly the one that they used. So that is art.
Do you know how they make that, the box drum, or can you describe the box drum?
It's made out of wood. The first box drum dance that I ever saw was when I was about 9 years old. And it was made out of wood. And it's like rectangular form. All wood on all sides, and it had designs on the top, like diamond designs, whatever you call those, all around. And it had a handle, and the man who was doing the performance was hitting it. You know, there was a stick or something that they can hit a box drum. So I remember the man going back and forth and doing that box drum dance. That was my first time. And then I've seen mom. Our parents were so involved in the Eskimo dancing. Grew up, you know, that is art. The dancing is art. I grew up with that. Our dad would be motion dancing, and mom would be motion dancing. And I remember they used to come here for the World Eskimo Indian Olympics, and they would be the number one Eskimo dancers. For a long time, they would be the number one all the time. So that is art, the dancing. Is art.
Do they usually have a lot of drummers, or do they do different ways for different dances? Do they have a lot of drummers for each dance? Like some places, everybody will have a drum, or some places there'll be one and it'll be a man and he'll be drumming.
This is our area. Ever since I can remember, the men had always been the drummers, and the women would be in the back singing with the men. And the one that you are thinking about is, I think, in Greenland. They have, you know, the member, just one man drumming. In our area, as far as I can remember, there's always been men drumming and women in the back singing. Yeah. Ivory carvings, yes.
Do you know the people that made these?
My nephew makes them. Different fossilized ivory. Ivory is from the walrus. It's pure white. When you get it from the ivory, it's pure white from the walrus. And then these were found down at the beach where it was fossilized. It's beautiful. The artwork from the fossilized ivory, it consists of black and brown and a little bit of white sometimes. The walrus ivory is when it's fossilized, it's got black, brown. So this one made by our uncle, Perry Akuchuk, he had made us this a long time ago because it's a family emblem. This one is made out of ivory. It's ivory. And you could tell, see, the art that is amazing when it starts fossilizing. This is, it's not completely fossilized. It's beautiful, but the way it starts aging.
Is this fossilized? Just
partially on the edge.
Just the edge.
On the edge, yes.
Inside, that's pretty nice.
It is. That's ivory. That's pure ivory in the middle, and that's first stages of getting fossilized on the ivory. And this is when you have jewelry like this, sometimes for many years or whatever, it starts getting yellow, like this. This was kind of white, but as it ages, it starts getting yellow. And this was made by, I think, Uncle Stephen Ekpeda. An earring made shaped in the polar bear. So there's different ways of different art work that is performed by our people up north with the ivory. And sometimes they would also just keep intact the whole walrus head with the ivory hanging out and hanging it in there. Homes and keep it as art work in the home.
Do you know what they use to cut it? Is this just a cross section?
A long time ago they would be very delicate. They would use a saw, a really diamond edge saw. But nowadays, I think they have, what do you call it? There's a lot of things that you can buy from the stores nowadays to make your job easier. But a long time ago, I remember seeing somebody using a saw to cut ivory. But they shape it, they have, these, what do they call those, sanders? They use sanders to shape, to make it smooth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Buffer.
Mm-hmm. A buffer. So it takes a lot of work to form all these little objects of ivory where, they make this different. And also this ulu shape. Some of them make ulu shape and some of them make round, different round earrings. Three round objects to form an earring. A long time ago, the men, I thought it was over. A long, long time ago, hunters would put ivory.
Like a piercing?
Yeah, right on their face, right there. And they say stories, when I heard stories about them, these people would be eating, like, or something, and sometimes the seal oil would be seeping from that hole where the ivory is. So that's
they use this as, they say a great hunter would have big, you know, ivories on there. Right where the jaw is, they would have big ivories. But they don't do that anymore. But that was something that they did a long time ago. Baleen baskets. I would like to talk about the baleen baskets. There's baleen baskets that I make by my our dad's Benzenayak's parents. Kinaktak and Kushak. They were prominent baleen basket weavers. And while I'm here at the University of Fairbanks, I'd like to go to the museum and see, because I've seen some pictures of them, of their basket. Baleen basket weaving. They were prominent. They made really good baleen baskets. Kinaktak and Kulhak, which were adopted parents of our dad, Rensanayak. That is an art. The art of making baleen baskets. All the intricate work that they do is stripping pieces, long strips of baleen all the way down and shaping it to where it just a thin baleen, and they weave it to make a basket. Just so amazing how they do that. That is art, a baleen basket, which was very prominent from our area, the baleen basket making.
I've seen a lot of baleen baskets with like this kind of thing on top, like a little polar bear.
Yes. And the name would be on the bottom with a round ivory on the bottom. That I have seen, and so I'd like to go over there and see what I can find, which were made by my grandfather, Kinaktak, and my grandmother, Kulhak.
Would they make them just to sell them? Or did they make them, like you said, they would make them to sell or maybe just to give as gifts? Were they mostly just looked at like a piece of artwork? Like if you got it as a gift, would you actually use it to put stuff in?
The baleen basket?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I remember, I think our dad's last baleen basket that he had. I rarely saw him make baleen baskets, but he gave one to our sister, the oldest in Rodanayak's family, Mary Ann. I remember he gave it to her, and that's an honor in our family. She was adopted out to our aunt, and it just warms my heart that she, you know, was honored to be given our dad's baleen basket. And she still has it. It's a treasure. It's a treasure for her.
A lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
You do like such small, tiny little the weaving.
Uh-huh.
I tried to do a birch bark basket.
Uh-huh.
It's like a different kind, but yeah. And we use strips like that big, and I was having a hard time fitting it all together. Yeah.
Yeah.
I could see like a bearing basket, how much work that would be to make it.
I think each one of us has a gift. If it's a gift, then you enjoy doing it. And the late Samuel Simmons, Reverend Samuel Simmons, after he retired from ministry and after he retired as a counselor from the North Loboro Substance Abuse Treatment Services, I remember him being involved in counseling people. He completely retired from work and then he started doing the art. It was just, it's a collector's item. The way he made out of ivory a man and a son, a little child, it's just amazing. So it is a gift. You really have to enjoy doing it, and it's a spiritual, the spiritual essence of our culture. That's just it. It's a spiritual essence of our culture, is to have that patience and the knowledge and the wisdom that you are given to create something. And I know he had help in creating. When I started sewing, that is an art. Our Parker making, that is an art. I remember when I first started working on making trimmings for the Parker and everything. I would say a little prayer and I would do a lot of meditation and just meditating while I'm sewing, and it's just like, wow! It's like therapy. I think you just feel so good creating something, and it's from your soul, and you don't call it work. It's not work. Art is not work whatsoever. It comes from within, from your soul. Whatever you are making comes from within your soul. It's an accomplishment when you're done with the parka that you have made. It makes you feel good. And so any type of artwork that you do, it's from within your soul. Makes you feel good and benefit somebody else when you make them a parka or mukluks. It's all art.
Hello, it's November 7th, 2005, and my name's Holly. We're talking with Edith Nagia. And one thing I actually was kind of wondering about, but I wasn't sure how to ask,
mm-hmm.
is even in our little book, that one that I brought that one day,
mm-hmm.
It says that Inupiaq believe in reincarnation,
mm-hmm.
and people are always confused about that, it seems like. Because of the word, just because of the word reincarnation and what people think of when they think of that word, and I think it comes from like more Eastern religions,
mm-hmm.
and I think you guys have like a different
spiritual aspect of that, because reincarnation is in reality when something from the dead comes to life, right? Reincarnation. And that's a definition of reincarnation. That's an English word.
Yeah.
And in our independent way of life, it has nothing to do with reincarnation. It's a spiritual continuation of somebody's characteristic. Personal experience. I'm named after Allah, our dad's mom, Allah. And at the same time, Allah was our grandfather's sister, Allah. And there's a special connection. Like I nurture Allah's grandchildren right now. It's something within us, within our spirit, within our soul. And I call her grandchildren my sonny, especially one of them, very close to him. I've never like when I say hi, I never say his real name. I just say hi, sonny. And I would never, I mean, it's just an automatic thing. And sometimes the other, it's not reincarnation, it's within you, it's within your soul, and you're spiritually connected to, like I'm named Sidran. There's another lady that I was named after, and I'm very close to her grandchildren. There's a connection. They know it, I know it. It's just a beautiful connection. That, you know, being named Sidran and being named Ayalhok. Ayalhok is connected to those people, and I'm spiritually connected to those people, and I'm named after Kalyavsuk, who was very poor. Our family, our grandfather, grandmother took her in because she didn't have anybody to take care of him. He would have died, I don't know, a long time ago. Poor people had a hard time, so they took him in, and she was like a nanny, I think, took care of especially our uncle George. He considers her a mother, you know. So Kalyavsuk is reincarnated in me in a spiritual sense, where I honor her name. The Kalyavsuk that I know, like, to take care of themselves, are meticulous, and like, I like lobster and, you know, steak and lobster, diamonds, gold. Well, why not? That's honoring her spirit, you know. I really love steak and lobster, and I love first class living. That's okay, that's all right. I'm not ashamed of it. I just feel really good about it, you know, but not to an excess where I'm not making the right decisions.
Making that more important than something else.
Yeah. Because I just realized helping somebody is more important than gold, riches and gold. Giving my wisdom is the most precious thing I could ever give. Because gold vanishes, material things break, they get old, but this is priceless. What I'm doing right now is priceless, it is. And
So, reincarnation is not the right word. I think you're getting it. Like, if I'm named after these people, I am spiritually connected, specially connected to the people. And my daughter was named after Bernice Mata Abiwarak, and she, one time, she was like 4 years old, and she started saying, like, Mom, I used to have a gray cat. And I said, no way, not one ever. We never had a cat in our family. And she was so persistent, she said, yes, Mom, I used to have a gray cat. And so I called my older sister. I asked her, did you guys have a cat? And she said, yeah. What kind? A gray cat. So it's not something eerie to us, because some people think it's the other side. It's not like the dark side. No. We have a high respect for the namesake, and we don't consider it witchcraft or anything that's dark. You know, dark spirit, it's not. And I guess that's the closest we can go to is reincarnation, if that's...
So, yeah, it's more like...
How do you define, in your mind, reincarnation?
Well, I think of the word reincarnation, you think of if somebody died and then their soul became another life form and was born back into the earth.
Wow.
And it was there.
Yeah.
The same soul, I guess it would be called, or something.
You got it.
But
you got it.
When you're talking about a spiritual continuation, sounds more like if you're named after someone, they've died, you might just have like some kind of...
Come in!
Like you would be able to get feelings or memories or different things from them.
Uh-huh.
And that's like the gray cat, maybe she, it was just like...
It's not
go over to this side to be done.
There you go.
Okay.
So your idea of reincarnation, you got it. You have it.
Okay. Um,
it's something, I guess, in not just our culture, it's in other cultures too. It's a continuation of the soul of that person, like you stated. And it's not something to be scared of. I think young people, with their innocent minds, they get scared sometimes. and I, I really do believe that everything is divinely designed, and the spirit continues even through a bird, the persons, you know. And it's not all black, it's not black magic or anything, it's just well, spiritual being. And so someday we'll say, aha! You know? it's a beautiful mystery. Anyway, from personal experience, I've asked Mom about, you know, ghosts and black magic, and we call it shamans, the bat shaman. She said, don't be afraid of them. Just be aware. Be kind to them. Don't be controlled by them. Like, she had a really strong belief in a good spirit. She really did. She had a special connection, a one-way connection, I could tell. And she took care of herself. I was just thinking about her. And she took really good care of herself. She was active, and because some people get addicted, like elders, you see a lot of medications and whatnot, and she knew when to quit whatever is wrong for her mental health, her body, physical health. She didn't take anything that's going to make her feel, you know, out of it. So the last time that we spent together was really special. She, like I guess I knew what she needed, I knew what she wanted, since like we were already spiritually connected as a mother and daughter. And I would go there and say, oh, it's just what I wanted. Wow, okay, I like that. And it's the same with my aunt right now. She's in her, like, she just turned 76, and sure enough, I went there and she was hungry. She was thirsty over there at the bazaar. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my aunt. So this morning when I woke up, I said to myself, you know, how I was brought up. Just be yourself and be kind and be helpful. And never be controlled over people's misconceptions or gossip or whatever situations they are in, they will always vent out to you and tell you things and all that. It's, don't let it affect you.
That that was your energy thinking about.
Mm-hmm. My mother did vent out. I think she knew I was strong enough to take, you know. And there'll always be people who are hurting, don't know how to control their emotions, and they're in pain, but they turned around and do it the wrong way, like with their anger, you know. So, I mean, I'm connected. I know for a fact that I'm specially connected, spiritually one-way connected to God. And other people might see him as a great spirit, as a higher power, as Allah, or as something. We all have a connection, a spiritual connection to, which I call God. And I always say I have a one-way connection. I do. And I keep in balance the spiritual. It's not just in the church. There will always be the bad spirit. Don't be afraid of them. They're not in control. The good. Like that Reverend Samuel Simmons song, there's a black dog and a white dog, you know, a dark side and a good side. So you, if you feed the good side all the time, then the dark, killing, murderous, violent side of you will never, you know, be in control whatsoever. Always be on the fight side, the good side. And it's just a matter of choice, a spiritual choice for each and every one of us. And I've been in the religion. I have been there. I know, and I refuse to be stuck in a box. I keep an open mind now to the people that I'm connected to. I could be, one time I was in a very busy terminal, big terminal, and I connected with somebody. She was so bright, her face was bright, so happy, and I knew, okay, that's a connection. Even though I didn't know her, we were already spiritually connected. I said, wow! So, one spirit to another spirit, one soul to another soul. So, in this life you'll meet people who will have a big effect in your life. Dr. Harold Kavilu had a big effect in my life. Mr. Truitt had a big effect in my life. Mrs. Carr, you know, certain people who, Mr. Truitt at that time, I hated him. He made me get up there and make a speech. But in the long run, I always thank him for. So there'll be people who will give you that push, you know. So, reincarnation, that's for each and every one of us to find out for ourselves, but always be connected to the good side. Don't give in to your anger or violence or anything that is not good or beneficial for our mental spiritual health.
Is there any Vedic name for God?
Abhavut. That means father.
Okay.
In the translations, God is our father. Abhavut.
That is father.
Yeah.
A-A-P-A-V-U-T.
Apavut.
Apavut.
Apavut. Or Gadim. We spell it, where is it? Like in our, this is a long time ago, Gadim, see? There's that. We still use him as God. In the, that's a translation of some of the, like in the 50s, I think, early 1940s. Our grandfather went to school and learned English, and he translated some of the things that the Presbyterian followed through, like order of service. Like some churches have, this is the way that they, and that's okay, that's all right, just as long as it doesn't get habitual. Some religions are habit. They have no soul, no spirit. It has a lot to do with
it's more like a chore.
Yeah,
you feel like,
yeah.
You need to do that, so you can.
It's not from your heart. If you believe and want to do something, like you really believe and you will accomplish your education, that's a beautiful journey, you know. And be kind, be respectful of others, and the spirits are happy. It's one beautiful spiritual realm that we are in as human beings. It's how we treat each other. And there's this culture that is so violent and angry, and how children learn what they live. They live being controlled and violent and all that, and that doesn't mean I have to be caught up in that, you know. I don't have to. I just say, okay, I'm not gonna, let's, so if somebody hurts you or say something or whatever, it has no effect on you, because that's his or her problem. So being respectful and kind and helpful, and continue to be who you are, and that's good. And different personalities, sometimes I would meet somebody and say, ugh, I don't want to be in their presence, you know. But in the long run, they become my best friend, you know. So so life is good when you think of it in a spiritual sense, when you're centered and wanting to do good to others and don't overload. Because this is a computer. Our brain is like a computer. Take time to think, don't think too much. Play. Listen to good music. Take a deep breath and be good to yourself. Be connected to your family always. Always remember that there's a good spirit. Yeah.
Can I ask about what you guys do when someone dies? Like, what the, how you go through the grieving process? Like,
it's open.
We learned a lot about Dells. Like, they have potlatches.
Uh-huh.
And they'll usually have, like, a potlatch a year or two after somebody dies, and they'll remember them and go through the grieving process like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys do something similar to that, or?
When my dad died in 1980, I knew when he died. I was at home in Cocteau LaCroix. I was born on a business trip. And it was Sunday, and I woke up praying. I was already spiritually filled, and I was praying, and I was packing for my dad or my mom and dad Eskimo food, what I can get, and people were giving me food for my dad, and so I was packing them. I could recognize his voice and say, oh, it's okay, it could be food for the people in Eskimo. And I knew right then and there he was in the spirit world. And I started crying. I was crying all the day. And so I went to my aunt's place and I heard the radio and say, Herman Rexford, that's her husband, Herman Rexford, urgent, please call 4611. And I knew that number. It was a hospital. I already knew. Our dad was already there in the spirit world and he was talking to me already. And so we cry. We cry a lot. Even after so many years, it's okay that, you know, tears are so healing. Like, if you don't grieve, you get cranky and easily angered or it's a good stress reliever when you cry. It's cleansing. And we cry openly. There's a lot of crying, weeping, a lot of expression of just, you know, that's part of human nature. We cry. Never be afraid to do that, because it's an emotional, it's a human thing, human nature. God gave us tears to cry, and if we don't, we express it in anger, in violence, and whatever, you know, we were made to cry. So that's what we do. And then after we, of course, start planning the funeral process, and people come over, like, with food. They bring food. And they have a inspiration, a spiritual, you know, they comfort you with their spiritual songs. And then we have the funeral. There's specials or singing or flowers. There was a whole bunch of flowers for our dad. It smelled like a Garden of Eden. He was an honest, fun-loving, like, honest. And that's how we live, with honesty and integrity and respect for others and children and self. And being humble.
So, I remember one time after he died, I was grieving for him, crying for him the following, because he died August 23rd, 1980, and then it was New Year's, and I was taking care of my brother's apartment. They went somewhere for
New Year's, for Christmas, and I was crying, I was grieving, remembering him, and so while in that process of grieving, I turned on the radio, and it was Dad on the radio, like on a tape, and I said, "Oh, okay, he's not dead. He's okay. He's alive."
So, oh, right when you were thinking about him on the radio,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, see?
That seems like a connection.
Spiritual, you know, connection. Yeah. So, like when our mom died, we fed everybody. We caught a whale, fed everybody on Mother's Day, and what's more spiritual than that? You know, there's always a spiritual connection there. And we call the funeral the celebration of life of Vincent Nariak, the celebration of life of Rhoda Nariak, the continuation of the spiritual realm of Edith Nariak. So everything is a spiritual thing. I love those potlucks. Isn't that beautiful? In our culture, it was our Eskimo dances. Okay, let's Eskimo dance. And dance, and, you know, like our sister Miriam had lost somebody, and the Eskimo dances uplifted her spirit. So that's what we do. We do our dances to uplift our spirit.
Yeah, I think in like the American culture we do kind of, well, I don't know if I call it the American culture, but I know like a friend of mine died like after I graduated from high school, the summer after that, and we had like a wake, and just our friends had like a band, and so the band played.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's wonderful.
You get all your energy out.
Yes.
You just don't like think. You just kind of like feel. And,
yeah.
It makes you feel a lot.
That's a spiritual awakening. Just remembering the good in that person. They come to you and talk to you, and they're not dead, they're alive, their spirits are alive. And it hurts like the dickens when you lose somebody that you love. But it seems like their spirits help you, they comfort you, and say,
oh, okay. Like the elder said, don't give in to your depression. Try and be happy. You know, a lot of people go to the wrong side of really being depressed, and they can't do anything. They just sit around and do nothing and be depressed. And there are people like that. Unfortunately, they are given pills, drugs. I don't like that. When somebody's like that, they go to the mountains and cleanse themselves. They deal with their emotions and their grief, and like fishing is healthy. Sewing is therapeutic. Listening to the band, drumming really as loud as you can, or screaming from the top of your lungs. Go to the mountain and just scream. That's therapy.
Yawning is therapeutic. Crying is therapeutic. Especially helping somebody else is therapeutic. Get out of yourself. Get out of the depression. Go. Go see the sunrise, sunset. If it's like this, just do something that makes you feel good. Yeah.
Yeah, I think when you lose like somebody in your family, it really like helps bring everybody together.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, I mean.
Some are, if they're too painful, it's too painful for them to even come to the funeral or come, you know. And you have to understand where they're at. You can't force somebody to grieve. They have their own journey. And so they say, some were born to be lost, and we shouldn't have to waste our energy in trying to save that person or to make him good, or it's wasted energy. Just be good to yourself. And surround yourself with healthy people. People who are your support. Like I said, who want to go to a cranky masseuse anyway? You know what I mean? Yeah, everything. Divinely designed, it's amazing. So it's everything spiritual. Do what is good for yourself, not what is good for your mom or your dad or good for, you know? Just be good to yourself and you'll come around. Everything's divinely designed. The roses, the flowers. Right now it's this time of the year, the Thanksgiving is good, Christmas is good. And by January, February, the sun rise, you know, the sunset, so whatever. Just, and they say time will get so fast. But don't be afraid. It's supposed to happen. Just the ghost, what is that? You remember that movie with Demi Moore? The ghost? Yeah, it's like that. Be good to other people. Be kind. And there is a dark side. We have to be aware of that too. And we know where they go. So the spiritual, common sense, be on the good side. So many questions in your mind? Anyway, that's from personal experience, you know. Laugh often. There's a lot of quotations that I get from books too, healthy books that I read. Dr. Phil Makes Sense, Oprah, Janis Joplin. I have a CD. I love her singing. Yeah. She sings from her soul. So, is this it? Is this the last session?
I think.
No. Tuesday and Thursday.